October the 18th, he celebrated his 33rd anniversary. That is quite a thing. Gives me a lot of hope to see him. He's very special to me. He has a very special place in my heart for several reasons, and one of them is the fact that he's the man that started the Sunset Convention. His grandchild laid it out such a way that other people could carry on with, and I think it's been a really great thing for us to have here. And I'll let him tell you the rest of his story. Tom.
My name is Tom Roman. I'm very grateful, recovering alcoholic. At one time, I suppose that I thought that I was a normal social drinker. And I did have a lot of fun drinking. And I loved the taste of this stuff. But of course, in the beginning, I did have a lot of party going and things of this type, which a social drinker can enjoy. But of course, as I know now, looking in retrospect, there were times of changes in my drinking pattern. And not all of it was fun. As it progressed, it became a little strange to me that I was getting away from the party type of drinking, and then becoming a lone drinker, so that when I was going into taverns, I would go in alone and shun the rest of the people in the tavern, go to the end of the bar and drink in a lonely fashion. Now, this didn't seem too strange for me at the time. I was not aware of any change in my pattern or anything that I was doing wrong. But as time went on, things changed to the point of where I was missing going home at night. And I was married and I had a very lovely daughter. And of course, that was followed by being absent from home many, many times. And then a divorce followed. And then I was hospitalized for an ulcer, very serious condition. And the doctors told me then that if I ever drank or smoked again, that would be the end of my existence. Well, I did stay sober for a little while because of that threat. And at the same time, I was president of a union in Buffalo, New York. And on one occasion, I had a glass of ginger ale in my hand, and somebody took it, good opportunity to spike the drink at me. And this was a return to drinking for me. Now, before I get ahead of my story, after my divorce, I forget just how long it was afterwards, I met a lady, very fond of her, and we finally decided to get married. We did. Now, I told her at that time that I neither drank nor smoked, and she thought she grabbed a brass ring, you know. She thought she had a gold mine. Well, it didn't take her too long to find out that I was nipping, and she took a dim view of that. And finally, I stayed out too late one night, didn't get home till real late, and she said that this marriage was not going to be successful. So she asked me to leave. She packed my bags, put them in the front hall, told me the trunk would follow later. I was rather pleased at that because of the fact that I didn't want anybody to dictate to me how I should run my life. So I went and I got a room, $6 a week at that time, could get a fair room for it. And I proceeded to drink. I had enough money in my pocket. I was fortunate in that respect. I was working. I worked for the same corporation for many years. But now I was starting to miss work occasionally. My father and my brother, who were officials of the same corporation, saved my job many, many times. But I didn't think anything of that at that particular time. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that my life, I didn't feel, was unmanageable. This was part of being a human being. All people that I knew were doing the same thing that I was doing. They were all drinking, they were all partying. They were all raising the devil whenever they wanted to, and nobody interfered in their life, so how was I different? Nobody could tell me that I was. I was cautioned by people at different times that I was drinking too much. One fellow told me, a high school teacher told me, he said, "Tom, you don't drink right." I said, "What are you talking about? I don't drink right." Well, now he said, "I've seen you under certain conditions when you were not behaving in the right manner." He said, "Before you go out and drink," he said, "you just take some cream, put it in a glass. And then," he says, "if you feel the occasion, you break an egg in there and mix it all up," and he says, "it gives you a good foundation." And he says, "the booze won't hit you as hard as what it does if you do what I'm suggesting." Well, this fellow, I listened to him because he was a very bright individual, always immaculately dressed, had a beautiful car, a nice condominium. So I looked up to him in a way, and I did start and think, maybe he's right. But I didn't do what he suggested anyway. Several years later, at one time I inquired, "Where is Ernie? I haven't seen Ernie in a couple of years." Well, I said, "Well, you know that tavern down at the corner of Tioga and Delaware?" And I said, "Yeah." "Well, Ernie is the man down there. He mops up the floor." And I said, "My God." I said, "Where does he live now?" "Well, he lost his car, he lost his home, lost his job. He's sleeping down in the basement of the Tioga Inn down there. This is the guy who was going to teach me how to drink." That didn't bother me at all. I thought that was terrible that this fellow had lost everything. But it didn't apply to me. Now, there were times when I thought that I might want to stop drinking, but it didn't last for very long, maybe a day or a half a day, something like that, until I recuperated a little bit. And I think that most people who drink recognize the fact that they have to go through hangovers, and this is not too bad. As a matter of fact, my mother and my wife, my sisters, they all told me that I could go out and I could get really, really drunk, come home looking like hell, and the next morning shower and shave and put a clean suit on. They said, "You never know that I was in that condition the night before." You see, getting over it physically was all right at that particular point. But nevertheless, after I came into AA, and in retrospect, I could look back and I could pinpoint these things, the change in the person themselves. That was me. I was feeling the change. And then I would have lucid moments that I think that I ought to do something about it. Now, what was I going to do about it? Now, along about this time, There was a fellow that drank with me at the office, worked with me in a different department. He told my wife, he said, "Florence," he said, "Pam is drinking too much, he's missing too much work and everything else," and he said, "We gotta do something about it." She said, "What would you suggest?" He said, "Well," he said, "the next time that he goes away from home," see, I was back home, I found my way back into my wife's good graces, and she allowed me to come back home. Of course, promising. He said, "The next time he comes home from one of his sojourns," he said, "you call me up and I'll come over and we'll talk, see what we can do with him." Now in 1949 it was, so they decided that if I went up, my friend Charlie had a good friend on the Buffalo City Court bench, Judge McKenna. And they thought that if I went up to Judge McKenna's office in his private chamber, so my job would not be affected by it, publicity-wise, that perhaps he could talk me into sobriety. And I went up to him, and he told me many things. He said, "I'm not going to put you on probation, and I'm not going to threaten you. But," he said, "there's one thing," he said, "I would like to have you do, that's a return to the sacraments of your church." And he said, "See if that won't work for you." So I agreed with him. I said, "Sure, that's what I'll do." You know, I was in between this and that, and I had nowhere to go. I had to agree. He was the judge. You heard the expression, "Here comes the judge." Well, that's it. So I promised him anything. Even to the point of one day I thought that I was sincere, you know. And there was a church in back of the city hall. And after one of the sessions that I talked to him, the judge, I thought, that's what I'll do. I went over to the church and I rang the doorbell and the priest came to the door. I didn't know what I wanted. What could he do? I said, "I'd like to take the pledge." "Okay, come in." He got a pencil and paper out and scratched the pledge out for me, you know. "How long do you want to take it for?" "A year." "Sure." "Okay. Sign here." I sign there. Folded the pledge up, reached in my pocket, and I give him $2. And I got out in front of the church. And I ran like hell up 2 blocks up to the Du Bois Tavern on Eagle Street. And I got drunk and I got mad because I'd give the priest the $2. I was drinking. This is the insanity. I took the pledge home and I handed it to Florence. I said, "There, now there's the pledge. I'm not going to drink for a year." Six of them drunk. We went through many trials and tribulations. She would see that I had no money in my pocket as I came home drunk one night. Got up the next morning, I didn't go to work. She would go to work. She would make sure that I had no money in my pocket to go out and get drunk. But what she failed to take into consideration was that I went down in the basement, down my locker, and we had beer and by the case down there. And we had also a bar that she had the keys to, the bar, the portable bar up in our apartment. She had the keys to that, so I couldn't get in that. But I go down, I get the beer, and then after drinking all the beer down the cellar, then I fill the bottles up with water. And we had guests where she'd offer them a beer and then pour the water off them. It was a rat race all the way through. So, long about this time, away, she asked me one night when I came home from work to go around the corner, which was a small delicatessen, to get a pound of butter for supper. And I said, "Okay." It was a Friday night, and I had my pay in my pocket. And just going out with the slacks and the shirt. Gonna get a pound of butter for supper. And on the way around the corner, I thought, oh hell, I'll go down to Bain's Log Cabin for a couple of quick belts and she'll never know the difference. So I went down, which was a little over a block away. And I got a couple of quick belts, I guess, because the next time she heard from me was 10 days later and I was in Detroit and I don't know how the hell I got there. I didn't even know what city I was in or where I was or anything of the kind. She didn't get the pound of butter for supper. She was mad because I had gone out that night and I hadn't left any of my pay home with her. So naturally, she asked me to leave again. And this went on several times. But always conning my way back into her good graces. And she would feel sorry for me, but she at times believed that I would live up to my word when I'd promised. On one occasion, when I returned home, I always wore a gray Homburg hat. And it was a light gray. And this time I went in through the back entrance. It was on a Sunday morning and she was in the laundry room doing her laundry. And she said that when she got one glimpse of me, the hat looked as though I'd been sleeping in a cold room, a light gray Homburg hat. You ever know what I'm talking about. Looks like hell when you think of it being soot all over it. And I didn't know where I was, but I turned and I looked at her and I tipped this Homburg hat, said good morning, and went over and got on the elevator and went up to our apartment, and then I locked the door and she had to get the building superintendent to unlock the door so she could get back in the apartment. Things like that, she took a dim view of. So finally, when I was living in a room and I got cornered on one occasion when my friend Charlie came out, after several meetings with the judge, they didn't know what to do with me, but I did after I came home from one of my sojourns. My wife called Charlie up and Charlie came over. And Charlie got in touch with the judge and it was decided then that they'd take me out to Marin Memorial Hospital, which was a place, a hospital, where you would stay for 10 days, a drying out place. They had two wards there with 26 beds in each ward. This was in 1949. This is before any of the hospitals in the area started treating alcoholism. Dr. O'Connor was the pioneer in that. And they took me out there. And the nurse, in the meantime, that morning I had shaved and got cleaned up, showered with a clean suit on. The nurse said to me, taking me into the examining room, she says, you don't look like an alcoholic to me. And I said, oh, hell, I'm not. I'm just doing this to please my wife. So the doctor examined me and he said, I'm not going to send you up there with a bunch of bums up in that alcoholic ward. He said, what you don't know now, he said, they'll teach you you'd be a lot worse off than you are now. I said, fine. So we started walking out of the examining room. And he only knew Charlie that brought me in there, but he didn't see the guy sitting next to Charlie, and there was the judge, Judge McKenna. And the doctor said to my friend Charlie, he says, I'm not going to admit this man, he's in too good shape. So the 6'4" judge, 250 pounds, stood up and said, I got news for you, Doc. If you don't admit him, I'm going to commit him. So I went in. There was no argument there. So I spent 10 days in there, and I came out of there because I seen some pretty horrible things there. Men admitted they're dying from drinking paint thinner, and I thought, I never want that. They told me many things, and I was visited by two men from AA at that time in the hospital. And the doctors and these two men from AA talked to me. There were four of them all told. These two men told me, they said, "Tom, now you live away, two blocks away from a very wonderful group of people at Westminster Church. And if you go up there, you'll be right in the same place where they can teach you how you can stay sober without drinking." They told me the time that the meeting started at 8:30 on Monday night. They had one meeting a week. And he said, "They'll hold open arms to you and you'll be perfectly welcome. Go up there and you'll be all right, okay." Well, I agreed. So I came out of the hospital, and within 3 days I was worse off than I ever was. Even after going into church and nobody shoved me in the church, I knelt down and I thanked God that I was out of that hell hole. These people dying and everything else scared me, and I was really sincere at that time. I thought I'd never want to go through that again. But within 3 days, I was worse off than I was before I went in the hospital. Now, what these men told me, I hadn't thought of for the next 2 years. Never once did I think of what they told me about this AA meeting. I returned home from work one night, and I started to go to the cocktail lounge, the Lamar Cocktail Lounge on Delaware Avenue. Now you get a picture in your mind of this. I was at the corner of Delaware and North, which was directly in the center. If I turned to my right, I'd go to the cocktail lounge. If I turned to my left, I would go to the AA meeting. And I hadn't thought of going to AA in 2 years. But that night, at exactly 8:15, I turned to my left and I went to that AA meeting. Now, there's only one person that could ever put that thought in my mind, that's God. So I don't ever really claim any credit for coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was guided to that meeting that particular night. There's no way I hadn't thought of those two men in AA coming visiting me in the hospital in any time during those 2 years. But that night at 8:15, on a Monday night, the only night in the week that they held their meeting there, and it was a discussion meeting, and there was one old timer there told me, he said, "Tom," he said, "if you just remember one thing that you listened to tonight," he said, "if you don't pick up that first string, you can't get drunk." Now he said, "another thing I'm going to tell you is you don't ever have to take a drink for the rest of your life." And those two things I came away from that meeting with that night. Nothing else that I remember went on that night at that meeting. I left that meeting and I went down to Richford Hotel, and in the dining room there, and there was a fellow that I went to school with sitting over the other side of the room. And I didn't want to go and talk to that fellow, although he's a good friend of mine and everything else. I just stayed by myself. And I think that what must have been going through my mind was what I heard at that meeting that night. But later on, I found that that man that I didn't want to talk to that night was the secretary of the central office in Buffalo, New York, this lad that I went to school with. And he died before I got into AA so that I would know that he was the secretary and whatnot. He died just a short time after I should have gone and talked to him that night. But do you know that I went back to my room that night And I lay in the bed, and I didn't sleep hardly at all that night, but I was thinking. And I got up, and I went to work the next day, and I didn't take a drink the next day. And I stayed sober all that week without going to any other meeting or getting AA contact at all. And the following Monday night, I went back to that meeting again. And you know, I wasn't planning on going to these meetings, but there was just something that I can't explain. Unless that God thought that I was so damn stupid, that he had to guide me in there and see that he would protect me until I got enough common sense in my head that I could think for myself. You know, these people tried to talk to me. I was so confused that I had to go to other meetings at other groups. And there weren't too many groups in Buffalo at that time. Now, this is 1951 I'm talking about. October the 18th is when I came into that first meeting. And for a period of 6 months, they tried me to get to go to other meetings, except this one meeting a week, and I wouldn't go. Finally, through a trick, they did get me to a meeting. I went supposedly to a meeting at Westminster, and the fellow said, hell, we won't go here tonight, we'll go to this other group. And that's how I got to go to another group. And I found the same people going there at that meeting too. So then I did start to go to a few other meetings. And that was the beginning of the growth in AA. I began to realize that there's something magic. I couldn't explain it. But then I wanted to go to meetings. And then by looking at the 12 suggested steps, the 12 suggested steps were incorporated in a book, the 12 steps of 12 traditions. And in 1952, the first printing of the first book came out. And I bought a book, and there were three young fellows, three of them were 26 years of age apiece. Now they got their heads together and they thought it would be good if they would go around with different groups and hold sort of like a seminar and discuss these 12 suggested steps as long as they're in the book form. And they had great success. So I thought, now these guys got something. So I too followed in their footprints. And I was thoroughly enjoying myself. And then I looked at that second step and I could recognize that here was something good. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Well, I was beginning to feel like a sane individual again. He had guided me into this fellowship, and I was beginning to think clearly again. You know, they also told me that it took 3 years for a person's mind to clear of the alcohol, the damage that it has done to the brain. This is not a way of trying to scare you people or anything like that. But it was enough for me to recognize that here I would be able to function, my brain is able to function so that I could recognize some good in the 12 suggested steps. And finally I got into them so deep and I applied them to myself. I thought that if it's possible for me to do these things, it must be that I am one of God's chosen persons, because here I am, I'm starting to think clearly again. Something I hadn't done for some time. I was beginning to understand what these people have, and they were offering it to me. They told me it's a one day at a time. Anybody can understand that. It's a statement that anybody should be able to understand. And to further my progress, I could readily see that by reading, I could understand the meanings of these steps. And I was told that they're all preparatory steps, one step for the other. You had to start with the first step. And after you felt secured, so that you could understand clearly what that first step meant, and then you would proceed to work on the second step. They also told me that nobody could make me get sober, and nobody could keep me sober. That this was an individual fellowship program offered by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after they found that I was going to continue to come to meetings, they also told me that there are no musts in AA. They told me the door swings both ways, in and out. If you want to come in, then you're here for all the good things that can happen for you. But if you're not satisfied and not convinced that you're an alcoholic, the door swings out also. We've got work to do among the people who want their sobriety. And that word want meant a great deal to me. Because they also pointed out that there are individuals who want to want. You see, you put two wants in it. But unless you want and do something about it. In other words, they said, faith without works is dead. They told me these little cliches and these slogans in the beginning were very important for me. Because in the beginning, while we worked on the slogans more than we did on the steps, in the very, very, very beginning. And they were very meaningful to us. Because you had to show some progress or else you wouldn't continue to go to meetings. And the progress that you showed was not only too visible to these people who saw you at meetings, they knew that. But they also told me that you had to feel inside that what you were going to do. In other words, they told me that I had a conscience. And nobody cared about me if I didn't care about myself. It pointed out these words to me very clearly. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. You see, they tossed the ball right in my hand. I had to do the thing if I wanted what they had. And at that time, I started to cultivate a liking for AA meetings. Now this is very important. If anybody finds it difficult to go to meetings, don't. Do what I did. Cultivate a liking for meetings. You know, there's nobody who tells a person we're going to send orders out for you and everybody else to go to these AA meetings. You'll never get them. And yet, the people come to the meetings because they want to come. Because, fortunately for all of us, we recognize that these promises are going to be made to us in page 83 and 84. They will come true. If we believe that we go to the meetings and do the things that are suggested for us to do. And this is the important thing. If we can cultivate a liking for meetings, because this is our classroom. And this is my classroom. And it doesn't make any difference whether anybody else considers it their classroom or not, because every one of us have the right to do what we want to do. And when we want to do certain things, the bottom line in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we recognize we have a problem, we have the problem of alcoholism, and we come to understand that certain people have come here, and they, through the one day at a time problem, they can solve their problem. Now, the quality of sobriety will come if we can accept these very simple things that are told to us in the beginning. It does take time for us to get the full benefit of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is one particular word, to continue, because there is no graduation date in AA. I am an alcoholic for the rest of my life. I'll always be an alcoholic. The thing that is that once we recognize, I had to recognize that I had a responsibility. After I had some of the benefits come true, that I was convinced that there were more benefits for me if I did the things that were suggested for me to do. I was telling Pat and Jack tonight about Bill Wilson in the Maple Leaf Gardens in 1965 at the International Convention in Toronto. When he got up and he read for the first time, I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I always want the hand of AA to be there, and for that I am responsible. There wasn't a dry eye in the place, and 18,000 people in that Maple Leaf Garden. The most awe-inspiring thing that I've ever encountered. I often think of that, and I often think of, as I mentioned tonight also, that right now, in the thousands of places, thousands I've said, not hundreds, thousands of places all over the world, that there are meetings going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are thousands and hundreds of thousands and a few million, to my way of thinking, of people who have come here and who are enjoying a normal way of living without alcohol. Out in California right now, and down in Louisiana, Chicago, Illinois, Buffalo, New York, New York City, New York. They're all over. And yet nobody forces people to come to the meetings. They come here because they want to come here, and they recognize what their problem is, and they also recognize that as the people who are willing to hold out their hand to help another alcoholic without asking anything in return. This is the way of life. And I was fortunate I was able to recognize that this, looking at this thing honestly, objectively, I said, now this, if I can live according to these principles, which are the 12 suggested steps, then the light dawned. This is a beautiful design for living. It's all laid out for me. All I have to do is do it. Now, after I recognized that, and I said to my wife one time, you know, this was after several years in AA, I said, you know, when I retire, I'll dedicate the rest of my life to the principles of this fellowship, wherever and whenever possible. And this I tried to do. It doesn't mean that I'm giving up my life or retirement to become a radical or I'm not or anything like that. You know, it's something that I count my blessings every day because of my sobriety. When I came into AA in October 18, 1951, I never dreamed of 1 year. I heard 1 year and 5 years at that time. You see, 5 years at that time, when I heard somebody say they had 5 years of sobriety, quite as a confidant to me because he was only 15 years old at that time. And I couldn't believe 1 year. What the hell, I remember I couldn't even stay at the office. I had to sneak out during the afternoon and the morning, get around the corner and get a couple of quick belts to get back to the office. Now, how could I go for a day? I couldn't. So this was an improvement when I found I could go for a day without a drink. And then a week, and then a month, and then somebody said a year. Ooh, this is out of this world. If anybody here is an alcoholic, you know what I'm talking about. So when I came down here from Buffalo, I retired a year early, and I got into the position of talking to fellows by the name of Crowder in Clearwater, and I asked him one time, I said, where are the conventions around, what towns or cities? And he said, they only have one. He said, that's the state convention. I said, oh, hell, I said, I'm used to going to conventions up Buffalo, I said, for years, and I said, I'm sorry to hear that. And he said, well, what is the, I said, there's enough people around here, surely, to support a convention. They said, well, how about the general service meeting and telling them about it? So they invited me, and when I told them my thoughts on it, and then the central office reps asked me to come and talk to them about it, and I did, and they said, well, you know all about these things, why don't you start? So that's how I started the Suncoast Convention. But it's been wonderful because a lot of those people, when I explained to them what I had in mind, you know, those of us who've been around AA for some time, we are asked to sit on a panel or to do a talk at a state convention if, after a time, you're well enough known so that you do. And it's very important for people to participate in this fellowship. You know, you just can't take everything and do nothing. So it was my idea that if I could interest enough young people to participate in a convention, that is to serve on as panelists, you know, then that would help them and it would make a convention successful. So we started out and we said, well, now you know how to do it. I tossed the ball in my hands, and the very first one I laid it all out, and it was very successful. It was successful enough so we made $650 profit on it. And I had gone to the central office, and I saw the central office secretary, Harold Davis, who was a good friend of mine. I had a lot of fun with it. I said, what the hell, you got no desk here, you got no kitchen table. And I said, where do you keep your records? He said, under here. And he had them in a box down on the floor. Oh, geez. Is there no adding machine? Yeah, I got one out in the back room. He went out, so let's see if he brought it in on the hand job, you know. Must have weighed a ton of things. All iron. And I said, no clock on the wall? No. You don't have that kind of money. I said, now you got it. So I went on and I bought an electric calculating machine that clears, and I bought a clock for the office. I still got it there. And the desk is still there. I went down and bought him a desk, bought him a filing cabinet. I spent the whole $650. And I'll sit at the central office the way I thought it should be. And of course, from that day on, then I started to educate, to the best of my ability, other people that take over and run the Suncoast Convention. It's run successfully ever since. So there's no one deal about it. I was very fortunate. Now, I've been very fortunate all through my life in AA. They paid me a number of honors, privileges. That's what they are, they're privileges for me to be able to do certain things. I threw myself into AA up at Buffalo for many, many years. I was chairman of the Western New York Area Assembly twice, and I was alternate delegate to New York, and one of the biggest things that I think was that made me feel good was before I came down here, they asked me if I would allow my name to be put up for regional trustees from the Northeast area of the United States. And I said, no, I told this fellow Jimmy, I said, I appreciate that. You're asking me if I would allow my name to be placed in nomination. I said, no. He said, why not? He said, we all respect you greatly here, and he said, we'd like to have you as a candidate. I said, no. I'm moving to Florida. I'm retiring and moving to Florida. So that was one of the great things. Many things like that have happened to me. You know, one time down in, there's something I just want to mention. There are no big shots in AA, don't get me wrong. If somebody asks you to do something, then I was taught early. You do it. You do the job. You don't refuse. And when you get that job done and you go back to the back of the hall, you sit down, you keep your mouth shut, until such time as somebody comes up and taps you on the shoulder and asks you to do another job. And then you do the same thing again. You do the job and you come back and sit down and keep your mouth shut until somebody asks you to do another job. And this is the beginning of humility. If you can do that, then that's the beginning of humility. You learn that there are no big shots, no experts, and no authorities in AA. But you're there to do the work you're asked to do it. You know, down in New York at one time that I went down there in general service work, they had an old timer there, and he was the fourth panelist on this one panel. And his topic was, how does it work? How it works. And the other three panelists took their allotted 15 minutes each. And this old timer got up, stretched his legs, and shook his shoulders a little bit, and he walked over to the microphone. He looked the crowd over, took his time, opened them all over, and he said, just fine. And he walked back and sat down. And I thought was a terrific way for me to think about how it works, you know. Such simplicity, and how else can you describe how this fellowship and the panels work? You know, sometimes people say that when you talk about spirituality or about God, they think you overdo these things. But I'll give you an example. One time I went to a state convention, which I was very fortunate again. They never had a state convention in New York. And the four chairmen of the four assembly districts in New York. Now, New York is made up of four districts. There are four delegates to New York and four chairmen of the assembly. Now, I was one of the chairmen of the assemblies, and eight of us went to the hotel just outside of Syracuse, the Randolph House. We went in there on Saturday morning, and we had our wives with us, and they went to Alan Ambo. The eight fellows got in this conference room, and we hammered out the very first New York State Convention to be held at the Randolph House in succeeding years. And they've all been very successful. We wound up Sunday night at midnight. In 2 days, we completed the formation of the first New York State Assembly. I just went to Buffalo, Niagara Falls, I should say, in July. We had our 22nd New York State Convention in Niagara Falls. So you see, when we talk about spirituality
tells us this, that we can become spiritual without being holy rollers or anything of this kind, but we can believe, and we better believe, that this is a fellowship. Now, one time, the St. Louis Church in Buffalo, Father Schwartz was a good friend of mine. I didn't belong to the group that met at his church, but I was down in the basement where they held the AA meeting. We had an attorney talk one night. I sat alongside of Father Schwartz. That was the first AA meeting that he came to since the AAs were meeting there. This attorney talked for 1 hour, and as his clients could hear a pin drop. And Father Schwartz said it was the conclusion of the meeting. He leaned over and said, "Tom," he said, "tell me something." He said, "What do you have down here that I don't have up here?" He said, "I sat and listened to this guy for 1 hour and 9 minutes." He said, "Hear a pin drop." He said, "All I have to do is get in the pulpit upstairs, and then in there about 2 or 3 minutes that everybody's hacking and coughing, which means get out of there. Yeah, let's get out of here." But he said, "Here you could hear a pin drop down here." He said, "What is it?" I said, "I think probably, Father, you got religion upstairs and you got spirituality down here." He said, "I think we have." You know, with that, I think it's a wonderful thing. You people invite me out here to talk, and I hope some of you people, somebody's got a little something out of our coming out. Thank you very much.